Well, your programmer's been off and running. Last 6 months, 15 trips. And so I'm back from all those trips and here for a while. And so I know that one of our listeners out there in Arizona, can you believe that WSLR gets listened to in Arizona, called me with a question, and I somehow got the number goofed up. And so I'm going to invite her to call back at the here at the office, 894-6469. By the way, that's 941-894-6469, with her question after the show. I usually stay here at the studio for a period of time after the show every other week. The weeks that I'm not on WMNF as well, our sister station over in Tampa, because those days I got to jump in my car and race myself to another studio. But I'm more than willing to answer your questions and to take your suggestions for future shows. You know, this show here on No Nonsense Nutrition, it's better late than never. And I had clearly planned to do this show this summer about the incredible benefit of these magic fruits called mangoes. And the storm beat me to it. The storm took an awful lot of mangoes off an awful lot of trees. So I hope I'm not too late for the mango awareness. But, you know, when we talk about vegetables, vegetables are generally have mild flavors or even accidental flavors in their roots and leaves and stalk, and strong flavors down in their roots like onions. And we usually cook vegetables because cooking improves their flavor and makes them softer and easier to eat. Granted, there's lots of vegetables that we eat raw, but the fruits fundamentally that we eat raw. And so, yes, you may make a peach cobbler this summer, or you may cook some mango chutney, but all in all, plants create these incredible mouth-watering, sweet fruits with beautiful aromas and eye-catching colors and nice, soft quality, velvety, delicious, beautiful, because plants are smart. They want to get spread around, and so they invite the animals to come and eat those fruits so that they can spread their seed. And when we look at fruits as a category, they're always a blend of the sweet and sour. It's always a combination of sugars and acids that give fruit their unique quality. They're unique in the way that they progress from being completely inedible to being delicious. You know, if you have an immature vegetable, if you have a little teeny tiny carrot, a little teeny tiny beet, they're the most tender. They're the most delicate. That's the same thing with young meat animals. You know, they're the tenderest. They're the most delicate. But immature fruit, that's usually when they're the least appealing. We may use green tomatoes in the fry pan. We may cook green papayas, like Natty Burns taught me. We may have some green mangoes, but we treat them like vegetables. We cut them small for a salad, or we pickle them, or, you know, make some kind of a relish. But in order to graduate from vegetablehood, fruits must undergo that process called ripening, and that's what creates their very distinctive character. You know, a fruit is a very distinct organ, and it develops from the flower of that plant, and particularly from the flower's female tissue, the ovary, which is what encloses the plant's maturing seeds. So just as the ovary in a woman holds the seeds of a human, the ovary that develops in a flower on a plant holds the beginning of the fruit. Most fruits are simply the thickened ovary wall, or else they incorporate nearby tissues. Apples and pears, for example, are made up mainly of the stem tip in which the flower parts are embedded. So if you ever look at the bottom of the apple and you see that the stem tip has a little star-like shape to it, well, that's actually the dried-up flower. So, you know, all fruits have these distinct layers, three distinct layers, an outer protective skin, an inner protective coat that's around the central mass of the seeds, or in the case of a mango, the seed, and then that thick, succulent, flavorful layer that's in between. So as fruits develop, they go through these very distinct stages of development. The first, of course, is the fertilization by the male pollen. And, you know, this is clearly an adult show, and so we can talk about the female ovule and the male pollen. And that initiates the production of the growth promoting hormones. So it leads to the expansion of the flower's ovary wall so that the fruit can develop. And, you know, we call it fertilization. That's what we need the bees and the moths and the bats and the birds for, because they do that job for us. Some very conveniently seedless fruits like bananas and navel oranges and some grapes can manage to develop without fertilization. But for the most part, that fertilization is required in order for us to get the whole process started. And then the very brief stage of fruit development is when these cells multiply and begin to create this little teeny tiny fruit at the base of the flower as soon as it opens. And then the most noticeable growth, of course, of fruit development, I was looking at it on my red grapefruit tree yesterday, takes place during the third stage. And that's when the storage cells, the actual carbohydrates, start to increase. And the growth can be really remarkable. When I was living in Arizona and I had melons, I actually took out my tape measure and I would measure the melons, and there were melons that would grow 5 inches around in a single day. And most of this accumulation is due to the expansion from the water-based sap that's inside every one of the cells. So the mature fruit are among the largest in the plant kingdom. These storage cells, like in watermelons, you can actually see them. You know, in oranges and tangerines and grapefruit, you can see the little teeny tiny packets, little envelopes of water-based sap is really what it is, but those are the storage cells. And so during the growth stage, the sugar is stored in these little cell vacuoles, or in granules of starch. And then various things are done to protect that plant. Plants make defensive compounds, everything from poisonous alkaloids to astringent tannins. They accumulate in the cell, and they're trying to deter pests from eating them, animals from eating them prematurely before the seeds are ripe. They also deter infection on the plant, infection from yeast and bacteria. And then when the seeds become capable of growing on their own, then the fruit begins to ripen and starts to attract animals to be able to disperse them, and the fruit is said to be mature. That final stage of fruit development is the ripening, and it's really a very drastic change in the life, because it what leads to the end of that cycle. If there are any starches in the fruit, they start to decrease, and the sugars increase, and the texture softens, and these defensive compounds disappear. And then the beautiful aroma of that fruit develops, and the skin changes color, most of the time from green to, you know, like an apple, yellow or red. And then the fruit becomes sweeter and softer and tastier. It essentially is advertising itself visually. But, you know, what happens with fruit is that it's ripening, 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 rotting, rotting, rotting. What's true is that ripening is this last intense phase of life, and then the fruit prepares for its end. It organizes itself in such a way that it's just perfect for our eyeball and for our tongue. And this host of enzymes that break down these complex molecules are active in this part of the fruit's life. And oftentimes there's a single trigger that sets that in motion. You know, 100 years ago, they found out that if you stored bananas near some oranges, then they would ripen earlier than the other bunches. And then California citrus growers noticed that any green fruit that was kept near a kerosene stove would change color faster. And that's how they found out I think it was in about the 1930s or so, that ethylene gas, it's a real simple hydrocarbon gas that's produced both by plants and by kerosene combustion, triggers the ripening in mature but unripe fruit. And so that's what happens when they pick green bananas and then they put them in a room and they fill the room with ethylene gas so that it initiates the process in a pretty organized way to allow the ripening. There's different styles of ripening among fruit. When this ethylene triggers the ripening, the fruit itself begins to produce more ethylene. And so you've heard of taking a piece of unripe fruit and putting it in a paper bag and closing up the paper bag for it to ripen. Well, essentially what you're doing is you're making an ethylene box. So climacteric fruits, that's a category of fruit that can be harvested while they're still green, but they do mature and ripen well on their own, especially if they're nudged by one of these artificial doses of ethylene, because there aren't really a lot of us that have kerosene stoves anymore, and don't think we'd be using them this week anyway. So what happens is it triggers the starch to convert into sugar. And so we get that real sweetness out of the post-harvest ripening. That was certainly the case with the peaches that were on top of the refrigerator yesterday. You know, they were only a day out of the store, nice organic peaches, but one of them already had taken up every bit of mold that it could. The non-climacteric fruits don't respond to ethylene. And so when we begin to look at, you know, other categories of fruit, they don't really get better after you pick them, like bananas and avocados and pears do, where they clearly get better after you pick them. So anytime you've got a piece of fruit and it's not really ripe, you can enclose it in a paper bag, and especially if there's a piece of ripe fruit around, you put the piece of ripe fruit in with the piece of unripe fruit, and it respires a whole lot of ethylene gas, and then the fruit will ripen quickly. But you don't want plastic because it traps too much moisture. So it won't work with pineapples and citrus and the non-climacteric fruits. You know, most berries and melons don't really store starch, and they don't really improve much after harvest. So they really depend on maturing as far as they can go when they're on the plant. And so you want to pick them and ship them as ripe as possible. That's why when I was taught that you run your fingers over the honeydew melon, at the point that your fingers stick a little bit on the honeydew melon, you know it's ripe. But if you run your fingers over a honeydew melon and it's like a bald baby's head and it's really slick, they aren't really going to get any better. So that's a little bit of the kind of stuff that botanists love to know about, and so hopefully you'd love to know about it too. You know, I didn't grow up with mangoes. Growing up even in Pinellas County, where mangoes, the old Tommy Atkins mangoes were raised, my daddy didn't eat mangoes, so my mama never got them. And we didn't have them in the yard. We had oranges and we had bananas and we had other fruits, but there were no mangoes around. So it wasn't until I moved over to Deerfield Beach, the Boca Raton area, where I lived for about a year and a half, and rented a house. And right outside the bedroom window was this beautiful mango tree. And as the mangoes began to ripen, and they were huge suckers, they were over a pound. And, you know, there's about 1,000 different varieties of mangoes, and some of them are small, the size of a plum, about 4 ounces. And actually, a couple of years ago, I saw a mango that was 7 pounds. But these were about a pound a piece. And I'm laying in the bed one morning, and I hear thud outside the window. And then a few minutes later, thud. And I walked around to the side of the house after I got up, and I realized that these 1 pound mangoes, when they hit the ground, made quite a sound. And that sound called the ducks. And so the area that I lived in, there were plenty of Muscovies and other ducks, and they would hear that thud sound, and they would run under the tree and start picking on those mangoes. And so I learned very quickly that the second that I woke up in the morning, I needed to walk outside the house immediately and grab the mangoes that had fallen under the tree before the ducks got to him, and I became an instant mango fan. That taste of peach and pineapple and coconut all together, only sweeter, I was a fan right away. And I was really fortunate because the mango that was outside the tree was a Kent mango. And the Kent mango, the Hayden mango, these are some of the better mangoes that grow here in the state of Florida. The Tommy Atkins, which is probably the most common mango that's sold, is pretty fibrous. So even though it might not list it, always ask the produce manager, you know, what they are, because we're starting to get some of these, you know, more exotic mango varieties here in Florida. As they've popularized, we've brought in more of these varieties that come, primarily from India, where they've been growing them for 6,000 years. India grows more mangoes than in all of the other fruits combined. And so the Kesar mangoes and the Alfonso mangoes, if you ever get a chance to put your teeth into an Alfonso mango, you will write me a thank you note, because it is the king of mangoes. I've never had more velvety flesh, and I've never had more of that calm, it's just a combination of almond and coconut and citrus and vanilla and pineapple and peach all rolled into one. The Alfonso is absolutely the king of mangoes. But if you're going out there to buy a mango tree and put it in your yard, you know, look at the Hayden and the Kent and the Keat mangoes, because they really are astounding. Now, mangoes peak here in Sarasota County, usually in June and July. Actually, they start to get available way back in January. There's some species. The mango that I have in my yard starts to flower in January, and actually it takes a cold snap to tell the mango to flower. But pretty much from May through August, you're going to get plenty of the Florida mangoes, and the Mexico mangoes are going to add another month on either side of that. So April to September, you can get lovely mangoes. And remember, they're just like an avocado. They need to yield to a little bit of pressure. Well, you know, when we look at this mango, one of the reasons that I want to put so much emphasis on this is what a powerhouse of nutrients it is. And the powerhouse of nutrients comes from my old buddy beta-carotene. You know, carotenoids are a pretty big family of compounds that are in plants. There's about 600 different carotenoids that have been identified, and about 50 of those carotenoids are commonly present in the foods that we eat. So there's alpha-carotene and beta-carotene and cryptoxanthin and zeaxanthin and there's just really a lot of carotenes, but really beta-carotene is the one that is the most known. And beta-carotene got a bad rap a number of years ago, all around 2000 or so, I don't remember exactly. They did a study that found out that people that were taking beta-carotene supplements that had been smokers actually had a higher risk of lung cancer than people that weren't taking supplements. But I'm happy to tell you that there was a huge cancer epidemiology study that was done on almost 400,000 participants in North America and Europe. And they found out that the more high beta-carotene foods that people eat, the lower the rate of very many diseases. It has incredibly potent anti-cancer and anti-aging compounds in it. Beta-carotene is a powerful antioxidant. And you know that protects the cells of the body from damage by free radicals. And beta-carotene is one of the carotenoids that is believed to enhance the function of the immune system. But very recently, they found out that in addition to their antioxidant and immune-enhancing activity, carotenoids have shown the ability to stimulate cell-to-cell communication. Now, that's something you probably haven't thought about, that cells talk to each other. And poor communication between cells, you know, if the neighbors don't talk to each other, it's hard to make a good community. Well, if you have poor communication between your cells, that may contribute to causing an overgrowth of cells, a condition which eventually leads to cancer. So anytime we can promote good communication between cells, then that nutrient that we talk about plays a role in cancer prevention. And that's absolutely true with fish oil. you know, when I talk to people about the fact that the most important supplement you can possibly take after a high quality multivitamin, multimineral is to take fish oil, molecularly distilled fish oil that comes to us from Scandinavia or somewhere in the European Union where the regulations are better than we have in the United States, so that we know there's no mercury or PCBs or dioxins or other heavy metals. That's one of the things that improves cell-to-cell communication. But a lot of evidence that shows that beta-carotene is doing the same thing. Plus, beta-carotene converts into retinol. It converts into the active form of vitamin A. And so there is a lot of different carotenoids that we call pro-vitamin A because they convert in the cell into vitamin A. And more we know that vitamin A isn't just the eyesight vitamin or the skin vitamin. Vitamin A has to do with a lot of different processes in the body. But we can certainly refer to vitamin A as the eyeball vitamin, because if you're one of those people who gets the glare of headlights at night when you drive and, you know, it affects your vision, well, then you probably need some more vitamin A. Beta-carotene's also been implicated recently in female reproduction. We know that the corpus luteum, when the ovary, I'll back up here, okay, I know I'm talking science language. When the ovary of a woman releases an egg with the potential of fertilization, that tissue where the egg came out reconforms itself and becomes what's called the corpus luteum. And it has the highest concentration of beta-carotene of any organ in the body. So we know that this nutrient plays an important role in the reproductive process, but we don't know a lot more than that. That corpus luteum then becomes the manufacturing site for progesterone. So women, as they head toward menopause, whose menstrual cycles start to shorten and they end up with 24 days and 22 days instead of 28 days, those are women that aren't making enough progesterone. So maybe I'm going to just speculate here, having higher beta carotene would make that corpus luteum stronger and allow these women to make more progesterone, and then that would stretch out that foreshortened period. Diets that are low in beta-carotene, that are low in these bright yellow, orange, red, and even pink pigments that are found in the fruits and in the vegetables, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's sweet potatoes or carrots or kale or spinach or turnip greens or collard greens or winter squash or cilantro. You know, broccoli even is loaded with beta-carotene. You know, when you look at broccoli, when it goes old, you can see it turns yellow. Well, that's the beta-carotene when the chlorophyll breaks down. So if we have a diet that's low in beta-carotene and carotenoids, it increases the body's susceptibility to damage from free radicals. And so I get worried with people that are, you know, doing some of these caveman diets, these paleo diets, who are really big meat eaters, and they're not getting an adequate amount of these beautiful yellow and orange and red vegetables. And as a result, their immune system won't work as well, and they will be at increased risk of chronic diseases like heart diseases and cancer. There's no toxicity to beta-carotene. I can recall, again, when I was living in Arizona and I was doing some carrot juice fasting, I did drink enough carrot juice that the palms of my hands and the soles of my feet turned yellow. It's very reversible. It's totally harmless. It scares the bejabbles out of people because you're like an orange Smurf. But they haven't found an intolerable upper intake level for beta-carotene yet. So the people that smoke heavily and that drink alcohol regularly, who already have an increased risk of lung cancer and heart disease, if they eat a diet that's high in beta-carotene, it reduces their risks considerably. And remember, carotenoids are fat soluble. And so, once again, if your diet is too low in fat, or if you have some sort of a medical condition like Crohn's disease or celiac or gallbladder disease that you don't digest your fats well, you potentially can have a deficiency of beta-carotene. But Generally speaking, we want to eat those yellow and orange and red carotenoid-containing fruits and vegetables every single solitary day. In my breakfast this morning, I had both peach and papaya. And once again, I thank my husband for fixing my breakfast for me on these Monday mornings when I get to run out the door. And I put it together with some cherries and raspberries and a purple plum. And so that nice bowl of fresh fruit on Monday morning is a great way for me to start my week. So when we look at mangoes, it isn't just the beta carotene that we're going for. They're also pretty high in vitamin C. If you eat a whole mango, you're going to get about 100 milligrams of vitamin C. And they're low in calories. I mean, even 8 ounces of it, even a half a pound, a half of a, you know, pound-sized mango is only about 135 calories. It's got iron, it's got potassium, it's got niacin, it's even got vitamin E. And we don't find vitamin E in very many things other than grains and nuts. And so that's a powerhouse of nutrients. Beta-carotene, vitamin C, iron, potassium, niacin, E. And then we throw in pectin to boot, the soluble fiber that we know reduces cancer across the board. You know, there's 6 or 7 grams of fiber in an average mango. And, you know, when I'm talking about an average mango, I'm talking about the ones that are most sold here in the United States. You know, these 12-ounce to 1-pound size mangoes. So when we get this fiber in, this combination of half soluble and half insoluble fiber, we add to the need that Americans have for fiber, because the recommendation of 25 to 35 grams of fiber, you know, I read food diaries in the clinic on a pretty regular basis, and I see people getting 10 and 15 milligrams of fiber. It's no wonder we sell 700 different laxatives here in the United States. So when we get that good 6 or 7 grams of fiber in from a mango, and half of it's soluble and half of it's insoluble, and a very good amount of it is this pectin that is a cancer protector, boy, that's a huge benefit. You know, one mango would have more fiber than a whole cup of cooked oat bran, and I can't think of a cup of cooked oat bran to sound quite as appealing as eating a mango. But the thing that's magical about this combination of beta-carotene and vitamin C and the other nutrients in there is how much it reduces the oxidation of LDL. I've talked on the show about the fact that the cholesterol-centric view of heart disease has really been thrown under the bus. That we know now that dietary cholesterol and serum cholesterol don't have anything to do with each other. But really, the only thing that matters in the cholesterol profile is called ox-LDL or oxidized LDL. It isn't how high the cholesterol number it is. It isn't how high the HDL number, the happy cholesterol, is. It's whether the LDL is already damaged. And a study was done using mango juice where they put people on it for 3 weeks, just a glass of mango juice every day. And I'm sorry they missed the good flesh. I bet the benefits would have been even better, but they needed to control it really well. And so they found out in just a 3-week period of time of people having a small glass of mango juice in the morning that there was much less damage to their LDLs. And this is important because it's these oxidized LDLs that really set up heart disease. So now you see that you've got a perfect package, except for the fact that they're really messy. The really messy part is it takes a while of peeling mangoes until you figure out how to take that one giant seed that's inside, slice it around vertically on the mango, twist the two sides apart, and then cut away that big seed to figure out how to use the mango. When I was eating them in Mexico, you know, they score the mango on the inside and then turn the skin inside out, and you just pop off those little squares of mango. But believe me, it's worth it, even if you have to put a tarp on to eat it. You know, mangoes are from a pretty unique botanical family. It's a family that includes things like pistachios and cashews, and, well, actually even includes the wood we see in our furniture called mahogany. And the bad news about that botanical family is that it has a toxin in it. And you've probably heard that urushiol, maybe you didn't know that name, but this toxic phenolic compound that's in the mango plant, actually just on the skin, not in the flesh. It's actually right under the skin. It comes from the same family as poison ivy and poison oak, and it's sumac because it is a member of the sumac family. And it can create an itchy rash for some people. And so, you know, I don't have an issue with it, and I've certainly gotten poison ivy in the history of picking herbs around the world. But you probably have heard somebody who says, oh, I can't eat mangoes, I'm allergic to mangoes. It's highly unlikely that they're allergic to mangoes. That would be a very, very low allergic response. But they may be reactive to this compound that is present in pistachios, in cashews, and in mangoes. And so that's the reason that you never want to burn mango wood. So it's definitely a no-no. When we look at this botanical family, though, we can really tip our hats to the people of India, because the people of India rever mango. There's no question about it. In fact, mango leaves and flowers are used in weddings, and they're used in ceremonies. They actually decorate their house on the Hindu New Year by hanging fresh mango leaves outside the front door because it's considered a blessing to the house. And when they use mango leaves at weddings, they're to ensure that the couple bears plenty of children. Only problem with that Hindu tradition is they only celebrate the birth of a male child by hanging mango leaves outside the house. Yeah, this feminist has a problem with that. But there's all sorts of things that the Indians do with the mangoes. There's actually a group in India that munches mango buds because there were Sanskrit poets who believed that they made your voice sweeter. But not only in the Hindi traditions, but also in the Buddhist traditions. The legend has it that Buddha found tranquility and repose in a mangrove grove. So we will often see the mango in the artwork of both the Buddhists and the Hindus, because Hindus believe there is no heaven without mangoes. And so tip my hat to all of those growers all over Southeast Asia who had their own mango groves and, you know, gave them to the Portuguese, and the Portuguese brought them to the West Indies and to Brazil, another big grower of mangoes, and gave us this fabulous, fabulous fruit. There's medicinal properties as well, especially in different parts of the world where plant medicine is bigger than pharmaceutical medicine. And so I had a caller on the WMNF show who was asking for a natural remedy for tapeworms. And I told him I didn't know of a natural remedy for tapeworms, but guess what? Yep, mangoes are considered to be a natural remedy for tapeworms. And it's because of the enzyme that they create. You know, there are enzymes in all fruits. There's enzymes in all vegetables, but most of those enzymes are not proteolytic. They aren't protein digesting. And so you've heard me talk before on No Nonsense Nutrition about pineapple and papaya and fresh figs and kiwis, those particular foods having pretty unique enzymes in them. Well, the magnesium and the lactase that are in mangoes are also protein digesters, but this is specifically in the green mango. And my aunt and uncle lived in Ceylon before it was called Sri Lanka, and I remember when my Aunt Eva and Uncle Charles moved back here to this country, one of the things that they brought with them was the Hindi spice amchur, and it was green mangoes that were dried and powdered because they add kind of an acidic bite when you put them in curries and marinades. And my Aunt Eva had become a really big fan of curry during the 6 years that they lived in Ceylon. And so in those days, amchur was not commonly sold in the United States. You can find it in most markets now. Oftentimes it's called green mango powder. But if you go somewhere that carries ethnic foods, you'll find it as amchur, A-M-C-H-U-R. And it's a meat tenderizer. And it's a meat tenderizer due to the enzyme Magniferin. And remember, all enzymes end in A-S-E and I-N, so Magniferin tells you it's an enzyme. But what else is interesting about this, and I don't know how Mother Nature plays these tricks on us, but green mango powder actually has lactase in it. And so individuals that are lactose intolerant, remember OSEs are sugar, lactose, need lactase, or the enzyme that digests lactose. And so green mango powder contains lactase. And so one of the very popular drinks that happens in India is a combination of a yogurt or a curdled milk together with mango. And what's true is that the lactase that's in the green mango powder helps to digest the lactose that's in the milk. So if you're looking for a meat tenderizer for a marinade, think about amchur, because not only will it add that acidic bite to it, like we use vinegar or wine in a marinade for the acid part of it, well, the green mangoes that are dried and powdered would give us that same effect. One of the trips that I made to Acapulco, they were selling mangoes on the side of the road, and they served them with ground chilies and salt. And so they would, again, slice the mango in half, score the mango, turn it inside out, and then you would sprinkle ground chilies and salt on top of it in order to enjoy the mangoes. And, you know, even the harvesters in these small roadside stands knew about dipping the mangoes in hot water to kill pests. So if you happen to have a mango tree in your yard and you know that there's lots of critters that are smart enough that they want the mango too, just dip them in really hot water and that will kill any pests on them. We don't need to use pesticides or herbicides on them in order to get the effect. So in India, they will take the unripe mango, not only making it into the green mango powder, but they will mix the unripe mango with chilies and vinegar and spices, some of the same sort of ingredients that you would use in a chutney, to make a pickle condiment that would be served with a meal. And so very many people are turned on to mango chutney as a result of having Indian food or, you know, having it for barbecue. I love chutney on a sandwich with a piece of chicken. And when my mangoes came in, and, you know, this is one of the challenges for those of us that grow fruit and all the fruit shows up in a short period of time, and you wonder, what am I going to do with all of these mangoes? There's only so many mangoes I can eat. Mangoes freeze wonderfully. And so when you slice them up and put them in a zip top bag in one layer and lay them flat in the freezer and freeze them, and then you can add more and just fill bags with them. Then I had all of these bags of frozen mangoes. Well, there's only so much chutney you can eat. And I love chutney. I love putting it together with, you know, spices and cinnamon and ginger and, you know, a little vinegar and a little brown sugar, and man, you got a great chutney cooked on the stove. But again, you can only eat so much chutney. So I have a juicer, and I've got one of those big old Champion juicers, you know, that's a big old heavy thing that sits on the counter, and I think the engine or the motor that's in there is strong enough to pull a Buick out of a swamp. But I took the frozen mangoes and I put them through the juicer, and oh my Hindu heaven, I had never tasted anything so delicious in my life, because it ends up with something like soft serve. It doesn't actually juice them. You end up with this soft serve pudding slash ice cream of pure mango delight. So for those of you that have a whole basket of mangoes and you're not sure if you're going to be able to eat them all, slice them up, put them in the freezer, run them through the juicer. I don't know that it gets any better. You know, they're going to get progressively sweeter as they ripen from the inside out, but they're not going to have a lot of color change. In fact, when you look at the Keep mangoes are the ones that stay pretty green, and they only get a slight trace of yellow when they're ripe. So don't sit around waiting for your mango to turn red, because ultimately it could get too soft. But because they ripen from the seed to the skin, they are going to get progressively sweeter as they ripen. And whether you eat them out of hand, or whether you make them into soft serve, or you put them in chutney, or you make them into a pickle, I can't think of any way that they aren't good. In fact, roasting or grilling them until they're black all over isn't a bad idea either, for those of you that barbecue aficionados. Just put your mango right on your grill and cook it until it's black all over, and then put it in a bag in order to cool down so that you can skin it and handle it. You know, mangoes are about 14% sugar, which is about the bottom end of carrots. Carrots are 14 to 18% sugar. Compare that to oranges, 18 to 22% sugar. I know it's a terrible thing to remember all those numbers, but, you know, that's what botanists and nutritionists do. So 14% sugar is really a great ratio of sugar to acid. And as I said earlier, it's this ratio of sugar to acid that gives each of the fruits their unique taste and allows all of these flavor compounds in mangoes to come out. There's 35 different flavor compounds that have been noted in mangoes. Lactones, terpenes, sulfur, all of them. And they all have benefits for you. So whether you're going to use the unripe green one as a sour, because it's twice as acidic as a lemon, so think about pureeing a little bit of mango and putting it on your fish. You don't just have to go to Thai and Indian and Malaysian cooking in order to enjoy this tart deliciousness of the unripe green mango. But whether you have it that way, or you just use the powder, or you make it into 100 different things, in every way, it's delicious. Now, the bark of it produces a gum. You know, a lot of these trees put out a latex. They put out a gum. Just like you see pine sap, you know, pine sap is golden. And pine sap is used on wounds by some of the First Nation people. And I can remember one time when I was visiting the Hopi Reservation, I got a big splinter in my arm. And the weed woman, as the herbalists were lovingly called in the First Nation tradition, took pine sap and spread it on my arm where the splinter was, and it was left there for a couple of hours, and then it had molded itself around the splinter, and then it pulled off the pine sap and the splinter went with it. Well, there are lots of gums or latex or resins that come out of trees that are used as medicines in different parts of the world, and the bark of the mango tree does the same thing. And what makes these things unique is, who was the first person that decided that that was a good idea to use to treat eye disease? You know, who was the first person that believed that a tonic that was made from the ripe fruit of the mango improved the liver, or stopped bleeding, or was used for snake bite or scorpion sting? Well, I don't know. But in the Hindu religion, where the mango holds a lot of religious importance, it's said that these insights were received in visions. And so somebody would have a vision, whether it was from the Lord Ganesha, you know, you've seen the elephant god, and he always holds a ripe mango in very many of his depictions. But Prajapati is considered the lord of all creatures in the Hindu tradition, and the mango is considered a Prajapati food. And so it's said that if you were to have a vision from Prajapati that told you how to use the various parts of the sacred mango tree for these various medicines, that was all you needed to know. And so, you know, we don't put enough importance to these myths from history, but in fact, they often give people clues as to exactly the direction to go to for research. But the most important part of the mango, as far as I'm concerned, is the part that's mysterious. And the part that's mysterious is something called anacardic acid. Anacardic acid, to my knowledge, is only found in a mango. I don't know of any other place anacardic acid is found. But anacardic acid is a sedative stimulant. And right now, if you're really listening, you're going to be stumped because you're going to go sedative stimulant. How can you have both occurring at the same time? And the answer is that a sedative quiets you and a stimulant, well, stimulates you. What it does is it makes you calm but alert. Well, there were enough stories about the fact that mangoes could be used in meditation, that mango fasts could help people achieve nirvana, that some researchers went to look at anacardic acid, and they found out that anacardic acid, in fact, is a sedative stimulant. You know, how it mediates these effects is not completely understood, but they found out that anacardic acid had anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial and antioxidant effect. And it had anti-tumor activity, and it actually sensitized tumor cells to radiation. So anybody who's going to get radiation for cancer treatment, you want to eat a mango before you go in. But what they found out in some of the most exotic research is that it affects something called NF-kappa B. Now, NF-kappa B may not roll off your tongue any more than anacardic acid does, but NF-kappa B is one of the things that ages tissues faster than anything else. There are so many genes that are linked to inflammation and tumor cell transformation and metastases that are involved with NF-kappa B that anything that we can do to inhibit NF-kappa B is surely important. And inhibitors of the activation of NF-kappa B are being researched now all over the world. You're going to start to see stuff in the popular press about NF-kappa B. I don't expect it's going to happen in the next 20 minutes, but I think soon, for those of you that are science readers and science listeners, you're going to hear about nuclear factor kappa B pathways that are involved in inflammation and in tumor genesis. And so, well, maybe the Hindis were right. Maybe it's a situation where folklore knew it before science knew it, that mangoes are magic, that it's not just the beta carotene and the vitamin C and the niacin and the blah, 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 potassium, vitamin E, and everything else that is present in the mango. Maybe it's not simply the fact that they're delicious. Maybe this anacardic acid is the reason that the Hindus say there is no heaven without mangoes. So if you're not a mango fan, well, give it a try. And next year I'll remind you in June instead of waiting to July when the tropical storm has blown many of the mangoes off your tree. But hopefully it will encourage you to get out to the market and try a mango. And I take James Beard's advice. You know, James Beard is one of the culinary heroes of our country, said to most enjoy a mango, you need to eat it in a bathtub, or at least in private, because it is messy, but it is delicious and